Te marae, welcome to First Up to Tahiki Te Oho for Ratu, Tuesday the 23rd of April. Con Nathan Rarerea Ho coming up. A South America correspondent, Kate Pereira Garcia, has news of climate change and dengue fever. Hugh Edwards leaves the BBC almost a year after being told to leave. Henry Riley has all the news from the UK. We meet a Rotorua woman who's fighting fast fashion, one tea at a time. And we start a new regular feature with the Department of Conservation this month. We learn about a parasitic plant that actually has a lot to give.
And then when it flowers, it produces these enormous amounts of nectar. And so lots of animals are using the nectar. It's a little bit like a meeting point on the forest floor, like a pub.
Everybody, welcome to First Up here, Tuatahi Ki Te Oho at RNZ National. And we will start on the other side of the planet today. In London stands Henry Riley. Kia ora, Henry. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Nathan. Hope you are too.
Yeah, made the assumption you're standing. I don't know why, but let's carry on. A year ago, this guy on the BBC taken off air. Today, long-serving presenter Hugh Edwards has resigned. Remind us of the accusations against him and the rest of the story.
Yeah, so this was a bombshell story that appeared in the Sun newspaper, which is one of our tabloid newspapers in the UK. They claimed that an unnamed BBC presenter paid a young person for explicit photos, which began when they were 17. This was all to have happened during lockdown. And the actual source of the story that emerged was the mother and the stepfather of the child involved. But then the issue was the young person said that actually wasn't true. This story dominated, and there were sort of Chinese whispers for days and days as to who it might be. Hugh Edwards' name was long rumoured, and then it turned out to be him. And really, this has been going on for some time now. It was in July that this story first broke. It's been July since he's been off air. He's still been paid by the BBC, but we know now that Hugh Edwards has resigned on what is being described as medical advice. Now, we do know that he was being taken care of after this happened. There were various stories regarding his mental health. His wife, Vicky Flynn, publicly named him and said that he was going through a very tough time and that he essentially needed some space and really explained the difficulties he was going he was sort of grappling with his mental health. And so I suppose it's reached its inevitable end, really, where Hugh Edwards, who many people didn't expect to be back on air with the BBC once again, has done just that and has now left the corporation.
Okay, meanwhile, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, reckons these deportation flights to Rwanda will take place in summer. Can you tell us about the Rwanda bill in the House of Lords tonight?
Yes, so this may well pass today. So what has happened is the House of Lords, which is made up of baronesses and lords and the upper house, have set aside essentially some changes, some proposed changes they would like to see. Rishi Sunak's government in the House of Commons are not having any of it and saying it needs to pass in its current form. It's all ready to go. And this has been sort of bouncing back and forth between our two houses of parliament, which quite often happens on these pieces of legislation that are quite complex. The government now saying they hope that the House of Lords will essentially agree to it and then it can pass today and the House of Commons can pass it. And then there was a press conference done by the Prime Minister today where he essentially said that we're ready to go, that we will hopefully have planes taking off in 10 to 12 weeks. And I mean, this Rwanda policy was promised back in June 2022. So it's been some time that we've been promised flights. So far, no one has actually been to Kigali or to Rwanda. And so we're still waiting. But I mean, it's clear the government are ready to do this. They've hired 200 caseworkers. There's 25 courtrooms, 150 judges who can hear some of these cases, speed up the process. They also say that they have a commercial charter flight booked, 500 escorts for the flight, 300 more people in training. So they're ready to go. But the issue is whether this legislation will actually be passed. And it's proven to be so divisive that it looks unlikely that it's going to simply sail through. If indeed that happens, well, quite where it leads the government remains to be seen, because this is one of Rishi Sunak's main five priorities to stop the boats. And he may well get it through today, but the House of Lords may well have other ideas.
Okay. Chinese spying is a bit of a hot topic around the world. A couple of men there have been arrested and charged with spying for China. What's the story in the UK?
We knew this for some time, and this has come from within Parliament, which makes it all the more worrying. This is Christopher Cash and Christopher Berry. Now, we hadn't been aware of Christopher Berry before, but Christopher Cash, who's just 29 years old, used to work for a group called the China Research Group, which is a China skeptic organisation, or so we thought, because it now turns out it's understood that that man, who had access to some very influential MPs, including the chair of our Foreign Affairs Select Committee, may have been spying for China and providing evidence which could be useful to an enemy. Now, he's accused of giving articles, notes, documents or information to a foreign state. This investigation has been carried out by the Metropolitan Police in London because they deal with counter-terror and espionage. And China have responded by saying the allegations are essentially nonsense. They say it's malicious slander and that they have no business in wanting to target these individuals. But this was reported some time ago. And the other worrying aspect is that Mr. Cash also for some time was quite close with Tom Tugendhat, who's our current security minister. So really worrying that this was allowed to happen, especially worrying that this man was, on the grand scheme of things, it would appear, posing as someone who is sceptical of China and all along has now been charged, we learn, with essentially aiding and abetting what, I mean, information that is not only highly sensitive, but as the police say, potentially useful to an enemy.
Yeah, it is. Henry, thank you so much for your time, sir. There we are, news from the UK with Henry Riley.
Well, we go to Japan now. Our correspondent Chris Gilbert is not in Tokyo. He's at the Onagawa Nuclear Power Plant. Is that true?
I am. I'm not directly outside, but I'm in the general vicinity because they're looking at restarting it again. And this is a big deal for a couple of reasons, because it's going to be the first nuclear power plant to be restarted in eastern Japan since, you may remember or may not, that nuclear meltdown thing that happened here following a tsunami and earthquake in 2011.
Yeah.
And this Onagawa nuclear power plant is in Miyagi Prefecture near the city of Sendai. And that's relevant because it's about 100 kilometers north of the Fukushima nuclear power plant, which is still wrecked and melted down and being decommissioned. It's on the very same coastline, Nate, that was hit by the... In fact, it was even closer to the epicenter of the earthquake than Fukushima was, and it was hit by the tsunami as well. Now, first of all, they're restarting this nuclear power plant. They shut down all the nuclear power plants. There's about 33 of them in the country in 2011, immediately after the disaster. But Japan imports about 90% of its energy. You may have noticed the yen is quite weak, and so importing that energy is very costly at the moment for consumers and for everybody. And also, a lot of that energy is coal. And so to meet its 2050 carbon neutral targets, it needs to look for alternative sustainable energy sources. And they're like, you know what, let's just crank up those old nuclear power plants we've had sitting around all over our coastlines. And so that's what they're doing, is looking to start up, not this week, it's coming up in September, but it's survived the tsunami and the earthquake relatively well. The reason for that is that the tsunami wall at the Onagawa plant is about 17 meters, whereas the tsunami wall at the Fukushima nuclear power plant was just 5 meters, and we all know what happened there. So the Onagawa plant survived a meltdown, at least on that occasion. However, there are lots of concerns about this because this part of the country is very pretty. There are lots of islands, there are lots of peninsulas, which means there are lots of windy, small, narrow roads which are easy to be cut off. And following a nuclear meltdown like we saw in 2011, it's really important to get outside of the 30-kilometer radius of a meltdown location of a nuclear power plant. And if these roads get cut off, if people get cut off and they cannot escape the area, they're effectively trapped. But the long story short is that there is more nuclear power coming to a Tohoku near you, and that is the Onagawa plant in eastern Japan, despite the meltdown that happened not 100 kilometers away.
Wow. And also I see there's been another helicopter crash for Japan's military. Where was it? What's the latest there?
Yeah, no good news today. Another helicopter crash for the self-defense forces. It's the second in effectively 12 months there. On Sunday evening at about 11 p.m. local time, so it would have been about 1 a.m. Monday morning New Zealand time, there were two SDF helicopters, self-defense forces, and they were out on a routine training mission, and then they lost contact with them about 3 minutes apart. And the government is saying that it's highly likely that they collided in mid-air. They took off from separate aircraft carriers. They were on a mission, a routine training exercise to detect and attack submarines. That was part of the review of the personnel. There were about four people on board each helicopter. They have recovered one who has been confirmed dead, and now the search is continuing for the seven others. They have recovered blades and doors from the helicopter. They're trying to go through the recording to figure out what exactly happened. The Prime Minister on Monday said it's with great regret to lose a member of the self-defense forces on a night mission. And it's definitely a blow for the self-defense forces. As I say, a year ago, there was another helicopter crash near Okinawa, which killed about 10 people. The Marines, the U.S. Marines, who have a massive presence in Japan, also lost an Osprey helicopter with six on board in the past year. And in 2022, there was an F-15 fighter jet which crashed in Ishikawa, killing two people on board. So as I say, nothing really cheery today, but it's not a great run for the self-defense force. And for a bunch of people who had effectively just shown up for work, Nate, and just a really, really unfortunate, what should have been a day on the job had a really tragic outcome for eight people.
That was Chris Gilbert in Japan. Yeah, 17 past five. You're listening to First Up here at RNZ National with me, Nathan Rarere. We're, of course, based in New Zealand now. We journey around the globe to South America. Our correspondent in Argentina is Kate Pereira Garcia. Morena, Kate, how you doing?
Morena, Nate. Well, thank you.
A cost of living crisis has been lessened for some Argentine people. That's great. I believe those Argentine people are the senators there who've given themselves a pay rise. How's that gone down with the public?
Pretty much as you would expect, I would have to say. The people I've spoken to, I probably couldn't repeat on the radio right. What they've said to me in response. It's not a small pay rise either. They've gone from 1.7 million pesos a month to 4.1 million pesos a month, so more than a double the pay rate. It's about $1,800 US to just over $4,000 US. So not only was the vote not on the list of things that the Senate was going to look at that day, but they all had a copy of it on their desks. And without saying what the debate was about, without having an actual debate on it, they just decided that they would not say what it was and have a quick vote by show of hands, which over here, strangely, is not formally recorded. So you'd have to kind of go through the YouTube video of the Senate for that day to figure out who voted yay and nay. But anyway, they did a show of hands and more than not voted for it. Less than 2 minutes later, they'd given themselves double the salary. So understandably ruffled quite a few feathers, no one less so than the president, Javier Milei, who's on an austerity drive at the moment throughout the country. So he's gone on to X saying this is how the caste works. That's what he calls sort of the political elite, as he would describe them, of the country, and what he would attribute part of the blame for the economic situation that they're in. He claimed no one from his party voted for it, which is sort of true, but quite a few of them just abstained rather than voting against. And the vice president, who's the technical head of the Senate, but she doesn't get a vote, and she said basically there was nothing she could do about it. It was all within the rules.
Ah, yes. Well done to them, I suppose. Hey, dengue fever has flared up, I know, particularly in Samoa near us, also continuing to cause some problems throughout South America too.
Yeah, it's been big over here for a while. It was sad to see that it had spread to Samoa as well, but it's got to such a problem over here that the UN agency, the Pan American Health Organization, has called it an emergency situation. There had been some indication that the numbers in Argentina and Brazil, which are the worst hit, had sort of stabilized, but they still are incredibly high. 5.2 million cases in the Americas this year. And of course, we're, 4 months into this year, so that's a lot of people. And also living here, I have to question how they get the actually recorded cases, sort of like those COVID numbers, how many people are officially recording that they've got it unless they get very sick, you know, those lower level cases, because it's incredibly common. You will know someone that's got it every week. If it's not in your household, it'll be someone else. Kids are missing days of school because there aren't enough teachers to keep all the classrooms open. There's a little bit of hope on the horizon. There's a vaccine which has been introduced here, but the officials say it'll take time for that to kind of kick in and actually bring down case numbers.
And I see power cuts are a problem in Ecuador at the moment.
Yeah, problems all around in Ecuador, really. But the power cuts are huge power cuts. They've had a massive drought, and a drought for quite some time, and also a drought in neighbouring Colombia, where they get some of their power from, that's been cut off because of the situation. It's all hydropower, hydroelectric, which is the problem. And so they had been trying to keep the power on, but they just couldn't sustain supply to meet the demand. And so it was going out unexpectedly. And the authorities said, to make it easier for people to plan, that they should actually just have rolling cuts. So in all of the big cities, sort of, they've got 2 to 5 hours worth of cuts where it's going out on purpose to try and keep the power supply going the rest of the time. It comes at the same time this weekend they had a big referendum. They've got some serious problems with violence. It's kind of all linked to organized crime, gangs, drug trafficking, etc. So they had a referendum over the weekend to introduce a number of security measures, joint military and police patrols, and extraditing wanted criminals, longer sentences for some charges like terrorism and murder. Exit polls have suggested that about 9 of the 11 questions posed in that referendum have passed, because even in the lead up last week, they had the head of one of the prisons, one of the big prisons in the country, the head of that, the director, was killed. There's not much details been released around his murder, but that it was literally days before they were all going to vote on all of these security measures. So it's pretty tough times all around, I'd say.
Yeah, but it is. Thank you very much for your time, Kate Pereira Garcia there in Argentina. 5:21, Nathan Rarere here at First Up. Local democracy reporter Diane McCarthy is with us very soon for news around Whakatane, and also our regular conversation with the Department of Conservation. It starts today.
Oh, oh, who are the people in your neighbourhood, in your neighbourhood, in your neighbourhood? Say, who are the people in your neighbourhood, people that you meet each day?
It's time to catch up and get, you know, find out what's happening around the neighbourhood there near Whakatane. It's our local democracy reporter, Diane McCarthy, who's with me. Always a pleasure. Kia ora, how you doing?
Good morning, Nathan. I'm good, thank you.
Tell us why there was a bit of tension about the recreational facilities during this first day of hearings for Whakatane District Council's long-term plan.
It was actually 2 days of hearings where the public got to give their thoughts on the proposed plan. And so that's everything they're planning to do over the next 10 years, including average rates rises of 17.1% in the first year. Compounding rates rises in subsequent years will equate to an average increase of close to 50%, I've been told. The big ticket item of a master plan for the new sports and recreation hub was the biggest bugbear for most of the more than 70 people who spoke at the hearing. These included a former mayor, Tony Bonn, and former councillors Gerard Van Beek and David Dowd. This proposal comes with a price tag of over $100 million over the life of the project. So with our rates skyrocketing and council already having said that they aren't able to raise the $400 million it's going to cost to keep our water services compliant with national standards over the next few years, it just seemed like a bit of an unnecessary expense to a lot of people. The council does tell us that half of that $100 million will come from external sources, and in order to get that external funding there needs to be a plan in place, hence the master plan. Yeah, so
I can understand why people were a bit upset about a big cost just dropping into their lap like that, eh?
Yeah. There are lots of other ideas and submissions about just because this is the big chance that the public has every 3 years to tell councillors what they want, and many people took advantage of that opportunity. There were over 70, you know, submitters wanting to speak at the hearing, and there's over 1,000 submissions altogether. And there's lots of people thinking outside the box. Ideas included integrating their retirement village into Rex Morpeth Park, like never mind the sporting facilities.
Yeah.
We want a retirement village in the centre of town. Some people felt that the sporting facilities, the council could actually go and buy some farmland out in the country and create sports fields out there, which would solve the other problem, which was parking at the big sporting events. Other ideas, plenty of people submitted that the council should abandon the boat harbour project. That the $30 million boat harbour, which the council has committed over $9 million to, which is supposed to be built in the town. There's a lot of people against. It's been quite an unpopular project with large sections of the community, and it's actually currently well behind schedule too due to some toxins being found from an old mill dam site. And council also engaged the community on the subject of the food waste collection, which a lot of people were against, even though it's sort of being mandated by government by 2027. One person asked whether he could opt out of having any public rubbish collection at all, because the costs it created, he created such a small amount of waste, didn't think it was worth getting his bin emptied every week. Mountain bike park was a popular amongst a lot of the younger submitters, particularly.
Yeah.
Kids in our town really would love to see a mountain bike park within where they don't actually have to get their parents to put them in the car and drive them to. A new bridge across the Whakatane River, providing better access into and out of town, has been on the wish list for many residents for some time now. And public toilets were a big issue. There's lots of people who would like to see more public toilets around the district, including in Awakiri, where there are about 7 retail businesses, including a tourist activity. Awakiri Rail Adventures owner Paul Francis spoke on behalf of the Awakiri retailers about the need for a toilet there, and he said people are using gardens. Oh. And it's, you know, not very nice when you're trying to run a tourist activity.
Overrated as a fertiliser too, apparently. Got to watch that one.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Diane, thank you very much for catching us up on everything. That is our local democracy reporter bringing us the news around Whakatane. It's Diane McCarthy.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
It's the 23rd of April. Happy birthday to you. If it's a special day for you, there are some famous birthdays on this day. Born in 1928, Shirley Temple. Ginger Ale, Splash of Grenadine.
And I have 4 years, sing Polly Wally Doodle all day.
Sorry, Shirley. Garnished with a maraschino cherry. She hated them, absolutely hated them. She said, all over the world, I'm served that. People think it's funny. I hate them, they're too sweet. Yeah. Born on this day in 1936 also, Roy Orbison. How about that? John Cena and John Oliver are somehow the same age. They are both 47 years old today. Valerie Bertinelli. I thought Barbara from One Day at a Time was cool. She's 64 years old today. And documentary maker Michael Moore turned 70. All right. On this day in 1927, Cardiff City won the FA Cup. Still, the only time it's been won by a team not based in England. Yeah. On this day in 1957, the Customs Signals Model B went into use, in a mass use around the country of the United States of America. It was a speed radar gun. There you are. 40 years later, Steve Kerrigan would spend $70 on a radar detector on the castle. Remember that? And they're driving to Bonnie Doon. His dad said, how much was that, Steve? 70. Just paid for itself. So there we are. On this day in 1985, bad idea. Coca-Cola had a drink everybody liked. Someone went, what about this? I've changed the recipe. And everyone hated it. It was called New Coke. Hence, when you go to the States, you will still see cans now called Coca-Cola Classic. And in 2005, on this day, a little film called Me at the Zoo was loaded as a test by a fellow by the name of Jawed Karim. It was the first video ever loaded to YouTube, and now it's got a few more than that on it. And those are your happenings for April 23rd. Thank you, Shirley.
Cash rules everything around me. Queen, get the money. Dollar, dollar.
With us from the business team, it's Anand Zaki. Kia ora, man. How are you?
Kia ora, I am well, thank you. I can't believe it's nearly 20 years of YouTube.
Yeah, I know, isn't it? And it's just everywhere now. It's prevalent, I believe the word. Prevalent.
And now it's getting old and there's new things that are cooler. You know?
Yeah, no, it's like, oh, I can't watch that whole 2 minutes. Give me 20 seconds.
Give me 5 seconds.
Yeah, give me that. Oh, no, too long. I see that job adverts continuing to fall. I mean, there's a lot of people going to the unemployment line just recently.
Yeah, certainly in our sector. And, of course, the public service, more broadly speaking. But, you know, you may have heard this in the news headlines this morning as well, but job advertisements, they keep falling, and for those jobs that are actually on offer, competition for those jobs is getting tougher. And now we have the latest monthly data from employment website Seek, and they show a 4% fall in adverts for the 3 months ended March, so the first 3 months of the year. And the good news is, if you can call it good news, from an employee's perspective, is the rate of decline in those adverts is slowing. But unsurprisingly, public service job losses are the biggest driver in the fall in adverts. And when we look at compared to a year ago, the number of job adverts are down by 27%. And now Seek say there were declines in adverts in education and training sectors, healthcare and medical, and also the government sector, which we've been talking about. But the biggest drop in job adverts was in media. No surprise to you and I, but we know how the media sector has been going, with more than 300 jobs in the sector affected by cuts. Excuse me. In terms of sectors seeing an increase in job ads, human resources or HR, probably not surprising given the restructures. And also we're seeing growth in recruitment, again, not surprising, and consulting and strategy, which is an interesting one, and legal sectors. But Seek say if you are in the public service and you have lost your job, unfortunately, it will be tough to readily step into another role. You know, we've had a surge in immigration, and that certainly made competition for jobs harder if you are looking for something new.
Thank you very much, Anand Zaki there. Not a happy report this morning, but you can hear more from the business team on Morning Report today at 10 to 7. Let's go to the money markets now. Your New Zealand dollar buys the following: 59.08 US cents, 91.98 Australian cents, 47.87 British pence, 55.5 euro cents, 91.46 Japanese yen, and 4.28 Yuan. Well, it's 25 to 6. Time now for the first episode of The Great Outdoors with Doc, where we'll be checking... Who came up with that name? Okay. We'll be checking in with the Department of Conservation each month to hear what they're getting up to out there in the wild. And first, I spoke with Avi Holtzapfel, who's the operations manager for the Hauraki area. And he told me about this really amazing plant, the pre-European Māori called the Flower of the Underworld.
Pu'otereinga. There's another lovely name for it. It's Waiwai Atua, or the legs of the gods. It's a very unusual plant. Most people wouldn't recognize it as a flowering plant. It looks, when you come across it, like a warty bit of wood or like a root burr. But it's an underground plant that lives on the host, on the roots of host trees. It's a parasitic plant, which means that it's fully dependent on these trees for its survival, mainly completely underground, and only when it flowers, it comes above the forest floor.
The way you've just described it, how do you actually know when you're looking at one? Like, how do you spot it?
It's either in flowering time when you're lucky and you see the flowers, or you just happen to see a bit of exposed tuber, a bit of its exposed body, and it's sort of characteristic. There's nothing else like this in the forest, but when you come across it first, you would just think it's an odd bit of root.
Does it have a particular smell?
When it flowers, it has a very strong smell, a very sweet smell, a bit like ripe melon or overripe fig. But during the year, I don't think so, although pigs smell it.
Yeah.
So I think for a pig, it probably smells very strongly as well.
Now, you mentioned something quite mind-blowing there, that it grows off, it's almost parasitic, it grows off the roots of the other plant. Why are they so important to the environment that they grow in?
Yeah, well, it's New Zealand's only native fully parasitic plant. So there aren't many of them in New Zealand. It occurs nowhere else in the world as well. So makes it quite special. As you said, it's fully parasitic. So it has no green leaves. It doesn't produce chlorophyll. When it grows together with the host root. It doesn't harm the host, doesn't harm the tree. And then when it flowers, it produces these enormous amounts of nectar. At a time when hardly anything else flowers in autumn in New Zealand. And so lots of animals are using the nectar and feed on it. It's a little bit like a meeting point on the forest floor, like a pub.
producing a lot of nectar, that's, you know, as far as I remember from biology, that was, I think, when plant sets, when they managed to pollinate themselves. There were no bees pre-European. So what pollinates this? Well, you know, what pollinates this plant?
There are actually bees in New Zealand. They are native bees. They're just not those colony-forming honeybees. That's right. Yeah, well, that's another part of that story that is rather unique. It's pollinated by the New Zealand short-tailed bat, another endemic only occurring in New Zealand. And it's probably one of the only flowering plants that's pollinated by a bat on the ground, because bats normally fly around and pollinate things in flight. But in this case, our bat is really well adapted to crawling on the forest floor. It sort of crawls on its elbows. It seeks out Dactylanthus and it feeds on the nectar. And while doing that, it pollinates, gets pollen on its face and flies to another plant and puts the pollen there. Yeah, that's the one pollinator that we know of. I'm pretty sure there are other pollinators as well that we just haven't seen.
Where in the country does this plant grow?
Today it grows in the North Island only, in a few spots, Central Plateau, East Cape, Little Barrier Island, small populations here and there down to Whanganui. But it used to be widespread across both islands. We're probably looking at maybe 5% of its distribution. So it's not as common as it should be, and it's not limited by habitat, because the host trees that it grows on, they are everywhere. We don't have any shortage of host trees. It's the lack of reproduction that makes it so endangered today.
Yeah.
And that mainly comes from browsing by introduced possums and rats and mice.
Oh, the good old possum again. Look, we have a lot of people in our audience with green thumbs who love to try and help these. If we're going to try and help with rescuing Te Pua or Te Reinga, can people grow these plants themselves?
And one of the ways that we're trying to now increase the population is basically creating new plants, new populations. And you can do it by taking seed and sowing it into suitable places where there are host trees. And the places where we've done it, quite a few of them have been successful. And the beauty is that those young populations, they will be probably there for 30, 40 years. So the plants are very long-lived. And that is a long time to, again, produce seed. And you basically take that seed and put it somewhere else, etc. So you can grow them exponentially once you've established them in a new place. So it's feasible. I think that's the way to go. Otherwise, the plants are just getting older and older, and the older they get, the fewer female flowers they get and the fewer chances they have to actually reproduce.
It's Avi Holzapfel, DOC's Operations Manager for the Hauraki region. Six here at First Up on RNZ National. We'll find out very soon what's happening on Morning Report. Mavash Ikram will tell us, will she actually take us to meet a woman fighting fast fashion. And the Finance Minister, Nicola Willis, updates us on the goings-on financially and also her trip to Washington. The professionals of the RNZ chip are here. It's Morning Report time. Let's find out what's happening with Corin Dan. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Nathan. Yes, we are here. Busy program this morning. Interesting story from Joe Moyer, our political editor, around a push for a review of the assisted dying laws. Both hospice leaders and ACT leader David Seymour pushing for a review of that and possible expansion. Obviously, there'll be a long way to go before that and that happens. It will be a conscience vote. But nevertheless, it's interesting that that is up for review potentially. We'll talk about the junior doctors, the potential for strike action there, obviously. Three strikes laws are making a comeback. We'll speak to the Prime Minister about that and a few other issues as well, including the fast-tracking legislation and probably the Waitangi Tribunal issue too with the 7AA, the clause around Oranga Tamariki. And we're going to talk to that chap who managed to complete a round of golf in just half an hour and shot a
speed golf. Yeah, the speed golfers. I like that, combining it. Thank you very much for your time. There we are.
Very good.
Corin and Ingrid with you after six. You may not be familiar with the term fast fashion, but it's one of the world's biggest polluters. Fast fashion involves quickly produced, cheap, low-quality clothing that doesn't last long. Nearly 35 million kilograms of clothes are dumped in New Zealand every year, and they make 400 million kilos of greenhouse gases. That's about the same as the emissions of 145,000 return flights between Auckland and London. But in Rotorua, Gail Heath is doing her bit to save the planet, one shirt at a time. Our producer, Marva Shikram, paid her a visit.
If I'm awake, my hands were moving. When we watch TV, I'm always knitting or crocheting. I can't just sit and do nothing. Usually the fabric tells me how it wants to be used and what it wants to be. Yeah, I've learnt to listen to it.
Gail Heath recycles discarded fabrics for a living. Several shelves and clothing racks full of her colourful designs line the walls of a small studio in her Rotorua home.
So this is a handbag made, knitted from old T-shirts and a few scraps of yarns and bits and pieces in there. When I knit, I would much rather knit an item out of scrap yarns, and I'm a great believer of why use one yarn when I can use 50.
Gail uses at least 30 different techniques to work with all her different materials. She says there's hardly a piece of fabric that she can't work with.
There is knit crocheted from all odd bits of yarns. So it's all, I call it my Pacific Ocean tunic. So it's all shades of blues and turquoises and a few greens. This one that you're just walking past was all shades of brown, and I called that my Kiwi cloak one. There's T-shirts, lightweight knitted jerseys, there's stripy garments, there's, you name it, it's in there. If the colour was right, it went in. There are a couple of sparkly ones in there somewhere.
Her other pieces include rugs, vases and bowls, all made from recycled cloth. But her go-to are old T-shirts.
T-shirts are probably one of my favourite materials, mainly because there's so many of them and there's every colour you can dream of. So I make rag rugs in about two or three different techniques using T-shirts. I have made clothing from T-shirts. Another favourite one is old jeans. I make kids' rompers out of old jeans, and they're reversible. And the other side will be something like sheets or a duvet cover, and they've been really popular as well.
Gail didn't always work with fabric. In fact, she started out as an accountant.
It is the most boring career you can even dream of, and creative people should not be accountants. So I actually opened a yarn and craft shop in Tauranga about 20 years ago. Prior to that, I'd made, ever since my hands were able to move, I've knitted, sewn, crocheted. Really got into recycling and textiles about 15, 18 years ago, when I realised that 10% of the world's waste, at least, comes from the textile industry. So we have to change how we do things. So that's been my motivation.
Her favourite piece is a medium-sized black and brown rug made from hundreds of discarded T-shirts and several metres of a fabric that was particularly difficult to work with.
This mustard, it is a T-shirting type fabric. It would be hideous to wear. It is the most revolting fabric to work with. I had to get scissors sharpened about three or four times just cutting the pieces for this rug. It's a man-made polyester horrible thing. Perfect as a rug because it's going to be indestructible. It's never going to wear out. If we flip the rug over, you'll see at the back it is an old coffee sack. So all of these old T-shirts and unwanted fabric are stitched onto a coffee sack backing. So the whole thing is what would be wasted materials.
As for the raw textiles, Gail says those are pretty easy to source.
Because there is so much waste material out there, it's so easy to get almost anything that you need secondhand. Most of my T-shirts are ones that can't be sold. There is so much fast fashion these days. The quality is appalling. People wear them two or three times, they wash them, they fall apart, they give them to an op shop. Op shops can't sell anything with marks, holes, stains. So instead of them having to pay for to dispose of it, I collect it. Other ways is Trade Me, Facebook Marketplace. Put it out there that you want people's unwanted T-shirts, stained, ripped holes, they're fine. You'll be inundated once people actually know.
A few months ago, Gail had to slow down after a botched surgery meant she could no longer work full-time hours. But that has not stopped her from saving clothes going to the landfill. She runs classes where she helps people learn recycling techniques.
If you've got a group of friends who would like to learn any technique, particularly rag rug making, but it doesn't have to be a rag rug. It can be a cushion, it can be a wall hanging, it can be placemats for your table. I'm happy to come and teach you. We've got a caravan, self-contained, so we can come to you.
And her favourite students are those who want to push the boundaries.
So I love teaching children because their creativity has not been inhibited. Yeah, they're very experimental, and if they say, can I do this? I will 99 times out of 100 say yes, or say, give me 10 minutes and I'll work out how we can do it.
Time for our regular catch-up with National Party Deputy Leader and our Finance Minister, Nicola Willis, who's just returned from Washington, D.C., and, you know, did the polite thing, asked her, how did the trip go?
Well, look, it was, I think, a very beneficial visit from New Zealand's perspective. And for me, a real reminder of how good we have it in our neck of the woods. Because I tell you, there's nothing more sobering than being at a dinner, as I was, with the Ukrainian Minister of Finance, the Polish Minister of Finance, and the French Minister of Finance, in which the words military, defence, and war came up pretty readily and, you know, really made me reflect on how, to some extent, we take for granted our secure borders and the lack of conflict in our country. And that is a very special thing about New Zealand, which we should hold dear.
Yeah. Actually, I suppose after a thought like that, and it would be something I know people would want me to ask, is this the time to be experimenting with AUKUS and seeing if we want to be involved? And because it might pull us into conflicts.
I don't think that we're experimenting so much as looking into something from the perspective of we're living in a world with a much greater range of threats than we've seen perhaps in more recent decades. And I think that underscores how important it is we keep those traditional security partnerships there, and that we do explore what options we have in the world, because Australia, the United States, they remain our good friends from a security perspective, and looking into our options, I think, is the right thing to do in New Zealand's interest.
You were away. The Prime Minister was also in the Philippines. And in there, I noticed he announced $41 million to help with clean energy in Southeast Asia. Why are we giving the Philippines $41 million?
Well, this comes from our international aid budget, and New Zealand has a tradition over successive governments of contributing to multilateral trade and trade for developing countries. And we do that as part of being good global citizens and contributing to a more stable world. And in the case of those energy contributions, of course, that's recognition of the fact that New Zealand should and will do what we can to reduce our emissions at home, but actually we also need to see emissions around the world reducing if we're to achieve our global carbon reduction goals.
But their GDP's $471 billion. Ours is $249. That's why I was baffled as to why they wouldn't even notice that money, would they?
Well, on a per capita basis, they are much, much poorer than New Zealand. So that's on a per person basis. You know, to take the example of Indonesia, their electricity generation relies around 61% on coal. Compare that to New Zealand, where we're just 3% coal, and you've got a really different picture. So if we want countries in the developing world to make that transition away from coal, then projects like this are a way of supporting that.
So if we're funding clean energy there, why are we possibly pushing through law changes for more coal mining here?
Well, the reality remains that there are going to be industrial reasons why countries around the world will continue to need small amounts of coal. In New Zealand's case, we are also looking to double our production of renewable electricity. And you've seen that we are introducing consenting mechanisms that would make it much quicker to, for example, get a wind farm going, get a solar farm going, potentially an offshore wind project going. And that's because we see the quite urgent need to change the way that our economy is operating in order to meet some of those climate change goals.
Okay. Turning to public service, looking for efficiencies, job cuts have been that way. There's 41 roles possibly going at the Department of Internal Affairs. But that includes staff that are dealing with things like child exploitation. And that team has identified thousands of online accounts too with child abuse material. Why is now the time to have fewer people in that role? Surely it's time for more, isn't it?
Well, what the Department of Internal Affairs have judged is that they can continue to deliver those really important functions without having to have the same number of people involved. And many people listening will have been involved in organisations where through better deployment of existing resource, through using good computer programs, through developing new techniques and new ways of doing things, that you can actually deliver better services. And in the case of the Department of Internal Affairs, they've been under really clear guidance that they're not to propose changes that they think would diminish frontline services, and they've judged that they can make these changes and still deliver on what you're right to call out are really critical functions.
They don't think the backroom roles going will realistically cut the impact of the frontline services. How do you monitor that to make sure that that is the case?
Well, we've asked that individual ministers continue to monitor their agencies over the coming year from two perspectives. One, to ensure that they are delivering the savings that they've set out to deliver, but also, of course, to make sure that they are continuing to deliver good frontline services. And there's a range of ways of measuring that.
Okay. The BNZ and Westpac economists, they believe the government may need to borrow $15 billion extra in the budget. Do you see that as accurate?
Well, no one can tell you what's going to be in the budget until the final economic and fiscal forecasts have been published, and not even I have seen them yet. So what BNZ are doing is taking their crystal ball and making some guesses. What we can tell you very conclusively is that we're sticking to our commitment, which is that we will not be borrowing additional funding in order to provide tax relief, because our tax relief will be fully funded through reprioritising money that would have otherwise been spent on government programs and through a couple of targeted revenue measures. So that means it's fiscally neutral, which means it's responsible, and rather than adding to inflation, we'll actually take away from inflation, which is what we've always set out to do.
Okay, so not borrowing, but taking out of programs.
We're reprioritising areas of government spending, and instead of spending that money in ways that we don't think we're getting good results, we're going to ensure that we can deliver tax relief.
That's Nicola Willis here at the program this morning to wrap out First Up for the day. And we've had some feedback through from you, as we always like to. Thank you very much. 2101, it's always good to get your thoughts in here. Barbara likes the new doc part of the program. I like it too. What do we call it? The Great Outdoors with Doc. I don't know, the name, we could workshop the name, you know, get a bit of that, get a bit of that happening. Right. Here's another one. Marg says, oh, as well, I so enjoyed your new conservation piece this morning, Nathan. Always enjoy the show in the wee hours there with Marg. Yeah, we need to go. I think Jeremy was saying before, you've got one of these plants, you've nailed it to a tree. There you go. How about that? Hi, Nathan. Great opportunity for a 70s TV theme with One Day at a Time. Yeah. We loved that. When we were talking about Valerie Bertinelli's birthday, there was a rabbit hole that was fallen in. Mike in Ahuriri, he says, your Valerie Bertinelli birthday shout-out reminded me that I had a teenage crush on her, and her marrying Eddie Van Halen in the early 80s was the worst day of my life. It wasn't just you, Mike. Yeah, it's lovely. Anyway, I thought one of the greatest comedy characters of all time was Schneider. He used to come around and fix, remember that, fix Ms. Romano's stuff for with his cigarettes rolled up in his sleeve. Anyway, Morning Report is next with Ingrid and Corin. We leave you with a bit of a toe tapper this morning. Roy Orbison was born on this day in 1936. Remember, you can download First Up the podcast and take it with you. Oh, we're back in your ears, our pawpaw.